So just as background, you may all know this, but there is a mass reassignment tool for accounts and opportunities where for this purpose, actually. So when a sales team changes and you're moving things around, especially for smaller organizations with handful of salespeople, you can use this feature in the setup menu to just bulk move everything over. Eric's not on the team anymore. Let's move it over to Paul. And it'll move everything appropriately. And you can do things like only move open opportunities or move all opportunities. And there's some flexibility there.
Hello, and welcome to Salesforce Trails and Trials, where two Salesforce architects and special guests share their wins and woes so that you can learn with us.
In this episode, we talk about enterprise patterns for writing code that prepares you for CI, CD, and packaging. We talk about SFXD and flow patterns. We talk about deactivating a user and the big things that can happen from that small change. We talk about creating unique solutions that tie in with others related to Apex and consuming CSV files, looking back at what your team is doing in Slack and celebrating them, the impact of a new bike, and some cool surprises on a backpacking trip in Suspe Creek. Cool. So, yes, I'm excited. You're going to have a nice little vacation this week. That's exciting. Mm-hmm. When's the last time you took a vacation?
We got away for a few days in December. And before that, probably August, just to drive down to LA and just to get, I mean, literally the word vacate, just to get out of town is the recipe for like stage one relaxation. I don't have to fly anywhere. I don't have to go very far. I don't need a fancy house. Just give me good food and somewhere to relax and good company. And that's all.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, it's good stuff. I really loved getting away for 3 days off the grid last week, backpacking.
Yeah, where'd you go?
I went to this place called Suspe Creek. And,
Was it like a deep trip, like 2 or 3 days out?
It was 3 days. Yeah, 3 days. And I found a few things on the trip that I'm going to talk about a little bit later.
But, okay.
It was just great to go with my oldest son and then a few friends that we met playing pickleball. And, you know, it was another family and the boys get along, and yeah, it was just great to be out there. Right. And it's quiet, you know, and
did you cross paths with anybody?
Yeah, maybe like 5 people, not a lot, you know, for Los Angeles, if you think about it.
And yeah. You told me where this was. I remember now, this is like the desolate 15 miles. You're like 15 miles west of Lake Castaic, which is what we all pass if we go up and down I-5 on the way to the Grapevine. I've looked at it on a map. There is nothing between Lake Castaic and I don't know, the end of that wilderness, which is 20 miles to the west. And you were there right in the middle.
Yeah. I met a mountain man who came from that direction. He was hiking up from like the 150 or some kind of small highway down there. And I was like, hey, how's the hiking? He's like, oh, it's bushwhacking.
Oh,
it's just nonstop bushwhacking, you know? And he shows me his arms and legs and stuff of all the cuts that he got, but he's like, it's great, you know?
Wow, so that's cool.
Get really out there. Meet people like that for sure. So it's good. I definitely recommend it. You know, for us connected people, it's nice to get like connected to other things as we disconnect.
Totally.
Right.
Totally.
From the noise. So let's talk about what we've learned lately.
Yeah. So let's see. You go first. What are you learning to?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know if it was you or maybe it was you. Somebody introduced me to SFXD a while back.
What is that?
So SFXD is a community, and I'll put the link to it in the show notes. It's essentially a community that meets on this kind of platform. It's more of like a gaming platform. Can't think of the name right now of the app it uses. Discord. Yeah.
Okay.
Discord,
yeah.
Right. So it's a Discord community where you can ask questions and just kind of like peruse like what people are talking about.
And it's Salesforce stuff?
It's all Salesforce related. Exactly. And there's lots of great people. I mean, there's Salesforce employees, there's architects, there's a couple vendors that's in there. And I really like the level of kind of scholarship in there. If you read through those articles, like people are working through some really challenging items and really trying to push the edge and do something really innovative. So I was kind of perusing, and they highlighted a little bit of some revisions to their best practices wiki. So they have a wiki and they were talking about some what they call structural conventions around flow. All right. Mm-hmm. So we talked in our first episode how flow is kind of the new standard for Salesforce, which is
right,
exciting,
for logic, right? Yeah, instead of triggers
logic,
or something like
for
that.
Automation, right? But now, just like, you know, the Lego example we gave in episode two, it can be done really badly too, mm-hmm. right? Like you can put flows together that create tons of problems, and they don't work well with large numbers of records and all kinds of stuff. And so I was really reading through their best practices, and I just felt like there was a tremendous amount of wisdom inside there. So I love that kind of stuff, right? You feel like you're peering over the shoulder of someone who's made a lot of mistakes for you, and it enables you to miss out on all of
totally.
That pain.
It's crazy that, I mean, you've been working in Salesforce since 2004. Before then, mm-hmm. when did you start working on Salesforce stuff?
Probably late 2003, yes.
Okay. So it's crazy that you find novelty in what these people are saying. I mean, you know, I know you've done a lot for other partners, and you've built apps for AppExchange, and you've, you know, you stump me when you call me on the phone on a Friday saying, "Hey, I got a question for you. Have you ever seen this before?" And, you know, but even it's so cool to hear that, you know, you're finding cool stuff on SFXD.
Yeah, no, it's really good. And I definitely recommend it. And I just think those, you know, I love adding value. So I've certainly mm-hmm. gone out and, you know, I shared it with you, with others, mm-hmm. right? Just to make sure that the people who are really good out there and who know their stuff and who want to invest and continue to make the community better. Because really, right, I mean, the developers, the consultants who are kind of helping make the, connect the dots for partners yeah. and customers out there, like they're the ones who are going to make this platform really work for people. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those people can add a great deal to this community. So that was a really cool thing I learned this week.
Cool. That's a good one. For me, I'm going to go back to a topic I just teased everybody about last episode, which is these enterprise apex patterns. And I'm still a student in this topic. I cannot evangelize it as a professional. I came across this. I'm working with a customer who has a architect who has written, or who attended a user group meeting, and they did a recording of his trigger framework. And the framework is a way to basically, you create one trigger, you know, per object. And in that trigger, you basically call every function that you need, where each function is a different operation you're going to perform when that trigger fires. And I thought, well, that's a cool way to organize it. And then he even went further and he used custom settings as a way that act like objects, basically. And he has settings to indicate, you know, which trigger fires in which order. So the order number, the trigger name, and whether or not that function is active are all parameters for every function. And so whenever you're going to maintenance, or you've got a problem with a trigger or a particular
or doing a data load,
you can just deactivate them with point and click by going into custom settings and going click, 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 and deactivating. Mm-hmm. So I thought that's pretty cool. And then on a side note, I started learning about packaging. I had a bunch of customers asking me about packaging, and they have these questions about, but when my new app that I built has two fields that are on the account record and I want to package it, now I need to somehow, if my SQL, you know, in my Apex references those two fields, how do I package this? Because there are dependencies. We talked about last episode that there's this shadow index that Salesforce is great with. You know, it helps the configuring admin know if they're about to do something that has, you know, implications for dependencies. But it also now creates a web of ties across objects and code that makes things complicated for packaging. And it turns out there is a solution. Salesforce didn't really need the solution until packaging came out and got more popular. And the solution actually comes from not Salesforce, but general enterprise application development theory from the 90s. And I forget the gentleman's name. It's in the trailhead. But go check out Enterprise Apex Patterns, if you're a programmer. It really applies to people who are writing classes and triggers and logic on Salesforce and then going into packaging. And there is a service layer module, a domain module, and a selector module that I mentioned last week. It's kind of like graduate level thinking on, to me at least, on how to write a trigger, how to write a class. I learned how to write a class by just hacking it through. You know, I wrote a Visual Force controller and I put a Visual Force page on top and it was simple. And that's all I need to do. And frankly, as a technical architect on the sales team, that's all I need to do to get my concept across. But when you're a professional service person or an implementer like you've done, or like my customers do, there is actually a reality that you have to deal with of like, how do I make this scalable? How do I avoid having three triggers on one object or nine or whatever happens in reality? And how do I organize my logic when there is, I would have to worry about order of execution because triggers fire first, but then flows fire and other things fire in different order. And some people spread logic out across multiple sort of mediums, if you will, or layers within logic. So all that to say, there is a really cool and organized way to handle logic on the platform that not only makes it better to maintain, but also better for automation and collaboration across teams and using GitHub to store your logic. It probably involved, well, before I go further, have you seen this in real life anywhere?
So I've seen the use of custom settings to create preferences around certain Apex classes and triggers. So we've actually implemented some solutions. Mm-hmm. You know, there certainly starts with packaging with an ISV app, mm-hmm. you know, where you're going to put a preference pane and that affects kind of code deep in the app.
Yep.
But the same idea, right, can be true in just an org mm-hmm. where you're setting up these preferences. What I love about it is that typically, you know, you want to take advantage of kind of that wide band capability of Apex, right? So like, you know, nothing beats Apex when it comes to large batch jobs and dealing with large amounts of data and all of this. But the narrow band maintenance restriction of that, which is like, now there's very few people who can actually manage that. If we need to change something with it, if I need to disable it, mm-hmm. if I need to make a tweak. And so putting this preference pane kind of enables a wider band of capability of now the admins can go in and they know they can adjust mm-hmm. preferences.
Yeah. Put your parameters in custom settings. Yeah. It's sort of like the Windows registry, right? The Windows registry is where apps kind of go to get parameters.
And well, you hold can on. I'm getting a slight itch from my allergy. Hold on.
That was all when I was a programmer, I was using Windows machines. So that's where I go to. You're getting a rash.
Yes, I'm getting like a registry DLL right now.
Yes, we don't have to dwell on that. But yes, it's this cool parameterized way to manage your app. And if you design your apps in Salesforce to go look at the parameters of the registry, it makes it even mm-hmm. more configurable so that, like, I think you mentioned an example where there was like, you've seen apps from even AppExchange where if only they had put some parameters in the custom settings. Remember that story? Yes.
One example, I won't mention the app, but it essentially it's a like a data enrichment app. Mm-hmm. And so there's
so like it know, cleans your addresses or adds.
It cleans your addresses as well as it finds relationships between leads and cool. other accounts. Uh-huh. Right. And so you're not converting into new accounts. So it's kind of helps to weed out the potential duplicates, as well as understand in an account-based marketing model what get a bunch of leads that still relate to an existing account mm-hmm. that we have, right? But they're not yet qualified to become contacts. And, you know, Salesforce has these various queues behind the scenes, right? So they have the asynchronous queue, right? But the asynchronous queue can only have 100 items in it at any given mm-hmm. time. And then it goes into this secondary kind of waiting queue. Mm-hmm. It only gets processed when the 100 items are cleared out.
Okay.
But if you never get your 100 items cleared out, they essentially stay there mm-hmm. indefinitely
mm-hmm.
until they're manually moved. Mm-hmm. Right? And so with this app, it runs every 5 minutes.
This seems pretty frequent.
Every 5 minutes. It's pretty frequent. And so if you have a lot of data, it might take more than 5 minutes to finish.
Oh, now your job's back
up. Now you start a second one. and then a third one. Right? So, you know, when you think about going org to org, data size and the number of records is pretty variable from org to org. So that would have been a great opportunity to put a little configuration in there to say, hey, look, we default to 5 minutes, but go ahead and type in the number that you think is a good margin for you.
Right. As a non-programmer, go edit the setting. Right.
Exactly. It's just a basic custom setting. And if you have, you know, if you have large data volumes and all this in your org, maybe you want to move that up to 20. Maybe 30 minutes, right? Maybe you want to figure out how long it takes for the job to finish. Mm-hmm. And then maybe that's your time frame. They didn't include any of that. It's just every 5 minutes. Mm. And so now to basically work around that, we have to look at all the other things that use the asynchronous context, which from my perspective, most things should default to asynchronous rather than defaulting to synchronous, which is usually where people start in the beginning.
Every business user says it has to be real time.
Exactly. so that's
I always tell my customers, go back and talk to your business user and explain what real time is. Ask them how often they're going to check the report, how often they're going to act on the data. And they're like, oh, no, we check it weekly. You don't need real time. Keep going. Keep going.
Exactly. So, yeah, real time doesn't mean weekly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, exactly. So it's so that was an example, a great preference. That'd be a great use of a preference right there just to adjust it. And there's numerous other examples. And it's really not rocket science. I mean, with custom metadata now, the ability to package that with your app or your solution and, you know, back it up to GitHub, including the data that's included in that custom metadata object. I mean, it's really, really powerful. And I just don't think people have given
it's a good design principle. Enough attention.
It's awesome, man.
Cool.
So let's move on to, and then, you know, there'll be stuff in the show notes on all of that. There's lots of good stuff to link to there. So let's talk about just one small thing that has a really big potential consequences, right? So deactivating a user, right? I mean, it's a simple checkbox, Eric, right? I mean, like, what could happen?
I know.
You know, pretty simple.
Yeah. Is anything going to stop you from deactivating a user?
Well, I guess there could be, I mean, one, there, you know, there's a little warning pop-up that'll kind of like give you a little clue. Most people just click OK on that before they even
I've done the words.
You know, the only thing that'll stop you is like, there's a couple default users. Like there's a default workflow user. There's a default lead owner.
Yeah, that's what I know.
Right. So those will stop you from deactivating your user. I haven't seen things like, what if this is the only sysadmin in the org?
Well, that'd be deactivating yourself.
Right.
That's true. But you can do can do things like that when it comes to single sign on.
Perspective, right? Yeah. But so I think, you know, that's, but even without those, let's say you do that, it does remove you from certain other elements, right? So like, for example, if that user is participating in multiple queues from a lead distribution or any kind of queues you can have almost on any object except accounts, I believe, right? So that it's going to automatically pull you out of all those queues. And that means if I reactivate that user, I don't believe they get reinserted.
I don't think so either. So when you deactivate the user, it takes it out of all the queues. You don't get put back in to those queues.
No, it doesn't. It keeps them out. And then, they don't get put back in. So you'd have to manually put them all back in.
Assuming you've documented it.
Yeah. The other thing, assuming you've documented it, great point, right? And that's something that even with a, you know, like with a metadata backup, I'm not sure that all of that is supported in the custom metadata API.
I haven't checked that. A lot is. I mean, I check the list of supported things in the metadata API. Mm-hmm. A lot is supported. I'm surprised. There's always something that people need that's not supported. Mm-hmm. And the things that also aren't supported are often like, I look at them and think, well, that was a pilot feature that was somebody used for a while, but it's not something we sold a lot of. So there isn't an API for that, but there are some that aren't, you know, there are some things that are not covered in the meta API.
Yeah. I'm curious about queues because queues kind of touch on security because they can keep you from accessing things inside of a queue.
Yep.
If you're not part of that queue. Mm-hmm. And so usually security things sometimes have their limits on the metadata API, but they've gotten much better. So much more mature. Here's an example. So one time a client was calling and saying, hey, I'm not able to make any changes to my opportunities, right? Or to these opportunities. So we're like, well, that's interesting. So, you know, you check out other validation rules that are blocking. And this is the instance where the client tells you, hey, this is having a problem, but they don't really give you the error message that is on the screen, right? Or sometimes they say click OK and they don't read it. I honestly see that people do that so often, they don't even recognize that it's like an error message.
Right.
Like it doesn't even register that that's something I should be consuming and kind of digesting. And so that's an example. If you have Salesforce records, like opportunity records that are owned by a deactivated user, by default, it's going to make those read-only without a preference. Mm-hmm. I believe there's a preference. You can override that now, but by default, I believe it makes it read-only.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one instance that was ultimately the issue, is that they had deactivated a user that owned those records and they didn't use the kind of mass
updater
to reassign those records.
So just as background, you may all know this, but there is a mass reassignment tool for accounts and opportunities where for this purpose, actually. So when a sales team changes and you're moving things around, especially for smaller organizations with handful of salespeople, you can use this feature in the setup menu to just bulk move everything over. Eric's not on the team anymore. Let's move it over to Paul. And it'll move everything appropriately. And you can do things like only move open opportunities or move all opportunities. And there's some flexibility there. But this is one where if you don't do that all of a sudden, or you deactivate and then reactivate or just deactivate, there are people who won't be able to edit those opportunities.
That's right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Cool. Yeah. That's one. And a few years ago, I used this recently myself. They added not just deactivate, but you can freeze a user. So freezing keeps them active, doesn't take them out of queues, just doesn't let somebody log in. And then you can unfreeze them. And, you know, that's kind of an easy way to just do something less drastic. But
yeah, that's probably a good starter, right? To see the impact.
Have you seen the Salesforce admin app?
Salesforce A.
Salesforce A is what it's called. That's right. Yeah, it's got that. You can freeze a user on the fly right from the app. It's one of the better things. You know, I like that one. It's kind of a power control.
Nice. Do you ever use that to extort like any money from people?
I don't. It's only me ever in my demo instances, so I don't need to do that. But I like the handiness, the power that's in that Salesforce A app.
That's cool. The other element I was thinking of here is going back to something we talked about in episode 2, which is, you know, a lot of people can do these user-centric integrations, right? So they go and they like, you know, load Cirrus Insight with their own user and just uses their own user's API access, right, to the org. Yep. And when you deactivate that user, that integration
breaks.
Even like Pardot, right? So the Pardot connector, the V1 Pardot connector used just another Salesforce user. Mm-hmm. It didn't have its own connector like V2 does. Mm-hmm. And so if you deactivate that user, it's not going to stop you.
Yeah.
But now all of a sudden, all of your marketing automation, you know, your updates between the systems will stop.
Yeah.
And sometimes the root cause analysis on that isn't totally clear, right? It's just going to have failures. It can't connect. And so that's another example. It's just hard to know depending on how people are making use of that user.
Yeah. Right? You'd have to
Why it's always good to keep track of your API usage.
Exactly.
Reports, right. The little admin reports in there. Mm-hmm. It's good to see what's going on and what users are leveraging their user for integration.
Yeah. How many logins a day are happening for each user? When you see 350 for one user, you know that, or whatever. When you see more than 15 or 10 for one user,
like they're sharing their login.
They're sharing their logins or the logins being used for an API. That's right. The whole team is on one user. That's not allowed.
Right. Yeah, not allowed. Yep. So good stuff. Yeah. So you got to be careful with deactivating users. I think the freeze user, that's a really good one. Using the API usage report that's standard. You can't really search for it in the report menu, but you can find it in the admin reports folder. Mm-hmm. Very good and under leveraged.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good stuff. All right. So let's move to what we're excited about.
Yeah. Mine is, this is something very recent. We had a presentation last week where we had to show how Salesforce could be used for reverse logistics. You ship a bunch of parts out to a customer because they bought them, and then they find there's a bug with the part and they want to ship a bunch of them back and there's a serial number on the parts, or maybe there isn't. Maybe it's like, you know, resistors, something so tiny where they come in a pack of 1,000. And what could happen in those cases is the manufacturer just really wants a proof of destruction and to be sent back, and then they'll give you credit for whatever it is that you bought. So there's a whole workflow that goes between four different systems. There's an ERP involvement to look at, you know, the financial side of the transaction and the assets. Does the customer actually own this product and what location was it sent to? Do they own the warranty? There's a warehouse management side of this where they, you know, you have to scan a part into the warehouse when it comes back or ship out a replacement. There's CRM because there's a case that gets logged for a return. And that's three. There's a fourth one too. I can't remember. Logistics, I think it's shipping information from maybe FedEx or whoever you're using for shipping. Mm-hmm. My part, so I have an architect I work with, you know, configured Salesforce to show that amazingly well in a week. It's a prototype. It's a solution, if you will. It's not a product, but it's a configuration of a bunch of stuff that's already in Salesforce. You get a case in. And then what you do is if it's an RMA record type, which he configured, you then get a screen where you upload an attachment of maybe a list of 100 different serial numbers that you want to return. And of course, we can take them one by one using a flow, but we also had to show as part of the requirements for the customer, hey, I need to upload a CSV file and then launch all your logic based on the line items that are in the CSV file. So what I was excited about is I was able to, in about 2 or 3 hours, go to GitHub, actually Google, look for CSV parsing Apex. I found a Visual Force page blog entry from 5, 10 years ago where somebody wrote it up. I know that I can pretty much reuse Visual Force controllers for Lightning controllers or for triggers. I got to do some tweaks, but I basically was able to find code that was already doing the right thing and apply it to this use case. And I put that code for my case for the demo in a trigger. I'm not sure that's a good place for it to be long-term. Maybe it should be fired as part of a flow, or you could fire it from many locations, but it basically just, as soon as you upload the file to the object in Salesforce object land, it creates a content document link, which ties together the attachment with, in this case, a custom object called a return item. So as soon as that content document link gets fired, this trigger fires, gets created, this trigger fires, and then the file gets opened, reviewed, scanned for each line item. It puts an array together. It saves those entries against that new custom object on the case or on the RMA entry and goes to sleep. And then all the other logic that my colleagues had created, which were verification flows. So every time a new entry gets put in the return item list, go and check and see if the customer has already purchased this. Go and check and see if, you know, there is a valid serial number. Go and check and see if there is a quantity or, you know, whatever the required fields are. All that worked. And so there are some status changes that happen when you do it manually. And I guess what's exciting for me, it's maybe silly, but oh my gosh, look, I wrote some code. I dropped it into Apex. It fires on a trigger. And then all the other stuff that fires when it works manually fires automatically when you upload your file. And so what was cool for me, or what I was excited about, was, woohoo, I dusted off my programming chops. And because that doesn't happen all the time for me, I talk to my customers a lot about how to do it, but I don't always get the chance to go create a project for a demo.
Sure.
And then look how everything worked together. So that was what's exciting for me. If we talk about that, I mean, that was something top of mind.
Yeah, I love it. I just thought it sounded like, you know, like a nice one-man band, you know, like you had the, you know, the keyboard and the drums on your feet, and then you had the, you know, the stick tied to your elbow for the cymbals.
I know, there was all, I just stepped in. It's like, I stepped in with the bass line, or I stepped in with something. There was this band that was there, and I just was able to step in and add something that, and what's cool also is this is now reusable for every demo we do in the future in this space, which is pretty popular in the high tech chip manufacturing space, where we're one of the areas I support. And, you know, I'll work to get it on GitHub and expand my my brand.
Nice. No, it's,
give credit, of course, to those who wrote it before me.
Right. I love it. Love it. You know, being a go giver.
Yes. There we go.
Awesome. So, you know, one of the things I mentioned that I went on this backpacking trip, you know, earlier in the call. And I think the thing I was excited about this week was I went the first 3 weeks or the first 3 days of the week. And, you know, for me, one of my axioms is that I really look for culture over competence when it comes to my team. Right. Like I would rather get someone who has amazing character, is a giver, a team player, total large appetite to learn, very curious, and knows nothing about Salesforce.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Rather than someone who's got 12 certifications and thinks they got it and they don't really need any help from anyone else. They're not really want to contribute to anybody else. But just as awesome as Salesforce. I'll pass on that guy. And so what's awesome is that, you know, when I went on this trip, it provides two opportunities, right, that really get me excited. One, you see that, you know, the partners and the other people that I work with, when they know you're going to be gone for 3 days, it's just kind of cool to see, like, out of the woodwork, they're like, oh, could I just want to get one conversation with you before you go. Mm. And it's kind of like, cool, right? Like, I must be doing something right, right?
Yeah.
Because, there seems to be a little bit of, you know, buzz, even though it's only 3 days. And the second thing is when I come back, you know, we use Slack as a great tool, right, for managing all of this. It's kind of a, you know, like a workspace tool that kind of replaces emails where you can organize things in channels. And then inside those channels, you have threads, little conversations that kind of create this timeline. Well, I get to come back and I just get to peruse kind of like, you know, behind the scenes. I get to see all the stuff.
It's like a replay of the work that happened while you were gone.
I get to replay. Exactly. I get to see how they're going back and forth and how they're like, you know, like making jokes and congratulating each other and, you know, like giving props and asking questions and being vulnerable and just like, basically delivering on the culture that I've been trying to build for years.
Very cool.
Wonderful.
That is exciting.
To do that and just to be able to then like add those little icons, you know, like thumbs up and strong arm and like, back in there on those threads. And so that was something I'm super excited about. Just, you know, I don't leave too often, but it's a really good thing to do it. You know, the team kind of like doesn't like it when I leave, but yet when I do, they always like surprise themselves by accomplishing something and having a great breakthrough, whatever. So it's a really neat thing to
see. That is super cool. Slack is, you know, we've all used a couple of tools, Discord, Slack, Chatter, you know, ICMQ. What was that one back in the late 90s?
ICQ. Yeah, nice one. Yeah, back to the AOL. Right? You've got IM.
Yeah, we've all used a bunch of those. What's really cool, and maybe this is me recently moving from Chatter over to Slack, is it is really easy to step away from my computer screen and still be productive. Like there's still people I'm talking to. They IM me or whatever it is. They Slack me. Mm-hmm. And sure, I always used to get emails and sure, I used to get Chatter, but there's something about Slack's user interface on mobile that just makes it easier to pop into a conversation, drop an answer, say, I don't know, refer somebody and get out. It's I like that. For me, that's an upgrade.
Yeah, that's super cool. So let's talk about something that inspires us.
Yep.
What inspires you lately?
So my daughter's friend came over this week for a couple of days, spent the night, and we needed a way to entertain them besides the internet. And it's beautiful here. The weather, spring is here, and we're thinking they should go outside. But my daughter has a scooter that's electric, which is actually really cool, and a bike, which she, you know, rides really well. But we live on a bit of a hill. And to put two kids out in the street where one gets the scooter with the motor and one gets the bike with no motor, that's a recipe for unhappy whining. It's my turn, whatever. So I went down and got my daughter a new bike, and she's 11, almost 11, and she's just on the cusp of getting an adult sized bike, which in mountain biking terms is called an extra small. So we went down to the store. We went to two or three stores. We looked at some. One store didn't have anything in stock. We went to the other store. We got the bike, brought it home, and she is excited about it. And when we got home, she wanted to go out for a bike ride. And that's awesome because anything I can do to get my daughter out of the house, and ideally, I want her to want to get out of the house. I don't want to be the one saying, turn off your YouTube, you got to go outside for an hour. And my mom used to do that with me. Go, I'll play outside. I'll call you for lunch. I mean, so maybe that is the role of a parent, is just say, go play outside. But it was really cool this week. She got the bike, and then that was on maybe Wednesday. Thursday, her friend came over. I mean, it was Tuesday. Wednesday, her friend came over. They went bike riding. They actually said, let's get up tomorrow morning and go for a bike ride. They got up at 6:15 on a school day.
What?
And went out for a bike ride and then came back, had breakfast, and then went to school. And my wife and I are looking at each other like, who is this girl who doesn't like, if you told her she had to exercise, she wouldn't do it. Of course, she's like me. But if I do it for fun, you know, I'll go skiing, I'll go play volleyball, I'll go do other things in life. But if you tell me to go run, I'll be so bored. So it's just so exciting that she has that independence. And then Friday night, we had this amazing time with the bikes. We came back from going out to barbecue or something like that in Danville. And they said, let's go for a bike ride, because we still got the two girls again. So I rode down with them because we were going to go on a longer loop. And then they met up with two other girls in the opposite cul-de-sac. There was like 16 people hanging out at the stop sign. It was like a parade. And then we did a loop with a little bit of off-road and then came back. And the kids were just like, it was like an idyllic moment of a, you know, imagine 10 girls, or sorry, five girls that are 10 years old from, you know, two or three different houses riding together in the cul-de-sac, having a good time, the sun setting. It's a nice spring day. It was awesome.
That's beautiful, man.
That was exciting.
Yeah, new bike,
that was
new
inspiring.
Life.
Yeah.
New bike, love new it. Life. Well done.
What about you?
Love it. Well, I mentioned, this backpacking trip I went on, and it's called Sespe Creek, and essentially runs parallel to this, you know, really small creek. It looks like a river at times. And one of the highlights is that there's a couple hot springs on your trip. So from the trailhead is called Piedras Blanco, right? The white stones.
Yeah.
And about 7 or 8 miles in from that is the first hot springs at a place called Willett. And the place is really nothing. It's just called Willett. There's nothing really there except this hot spring.
So you're like down in a valley, there's like an almost dry riverbed below you.
Yeah,
are you
exactly
on like a fire trail that's flat, a little bit up yeah from the valley? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it's mostly flat, not a lot of shade. It's kind of warm. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of funny to think about, you know, you're out there and it's pretty warm mm-hmm and you're going to go to a hot spring. How enjoyable is that going to be? So we went up and you got to hike up a half mile kind of up the mountain to get to it.
Did you have difficulty motivating your kids to in 90 degrees or 85 degrees? Okay, let's walk uphill.
Yeah, no, it's a little bit, you know, but it's like there's nothing else to do. That's and true. You kind of want to check it out. So you get up there, and I think what was really what was noteworthy to me and inspiring was that you can see what the original hot spring was. Mm. The original hot spring is this kind of like bubbling water that's flowing down the mountain. Mm. And that, you know, you could kind of put your hand up and feel it. But beyond that, it's not really too useful. It goes down the mountain and then it goes basically down the hill, mm-hmm, right? And creates this kind of slimy mess like down.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know how they did it, but somehow somebody got like this 3 foot high, let's say, you know, if you think about an out, like a above ground pool that's yes only 3 feet, maybe 2.5 feet high and maybe 10 feet in diameter. I don't know how they got it up there.
Uh-huh.
They would have had to like roll it or like fly drop it with a helicopter.
Right.
But it wasn't something that I thought the Park Service did. It seemed like just, you know, either like the CCC group, the people that clear the trails, they're like amazing, by the way. The Conservation Corps people, like maybe they did it or somebody, but they put this kind of 10 foot by 2.5 feet plastic, you know, trough or whatever. And then they went and they put together like a bunch of segments of like, you know, 2-inch PVC pipe. And somehow they went up to where that water was coming out of the mountain and they like shoved the pipe in there.
Okay.
So that some of the water would get caught up into the pipe and flow into this little, you know, shallow pool. And then they put one of those PVC segments on the drain so that the water level would have to get up to 2.5 feet before it then drains down.
Very
so
cool.
Like the continuity of the water cycle continues, right? It's still going to flow down just like it would, but it just stops for a little bit in the 2.5 feet of the pool so that somebody can get fresh hot water coming through. And they put like a nice like 4x12 beam across the side of the little pool so you could sit on it and put your feet in if you want. Or and then, you know, you just see around it, there's like little brooms and stuff. So people, as you use it, you just kind of sweep the bottom or whatever, just to keep the algae and whatever to a minimum. I was just amazed that like out in the middle of nowhere, right? Here's this kind of this open space where somebody has had very thoughtful design so that we can come and enjoy it and kind of better it. It kind of reminded me of open source software, right? Like I expected, you know, somewhere that there's like a little note that just said like, you know, mirrors are here and, you know, this was done by this person and all of that, because mm-hmm it just has that sense of altruism that somebody invested in this space,
mm-hmm,
coming up with an idea on how we can make this usable, but yet still keep the continuity of the cycle here and let the water flow where it needs to go. And then we'll just put the components around that, like help people to maintain it.
Right, exactly. So the maintenance
you just leave it the same or better than when you found it, and you can move on. So I just was like, and it was really, even though it was warm, like getting in after a 7 mile, it was a 7 mile hike the first day, you know, with a 35 pound pack. And then it was, you know, a 5 mile hike there the next day. Yeah. So getting a little R&R, you know, I put
it's
my
a hot
head
tub.
Back. Yeah, it was like, it's a hot tub experience. You have to like, you know, take a little snooze, and it was beautiful, but just the ingenuity and the commitment of getting all that stuff in there for me to use and to, you know, having the tools to kind of keep it clean and move on just reminded me a lot of just that altruism of kind of open source and GitHub, like we're talking about, mm-hmm, like the idea of GitHub as a legacy that we talked about in episode 2. So it was really, really fun time. The whole family, you know, the kid enjoyed it, and it was really fun.
Yeah, it's just a cool, it's a highlight of humanity. It's a backpackers that I've ever hiked with have always taught, you know, leave places better than you found them, not just pick up trash, but, you know, don't do campfires, don't leave burnt wood, don't, you know, don't leave a trace. And here, you know, somebody put in a big old tank, which I'm sure somebody would object to, but it's still, it's a community reward for anybody who treks 7 miles out into this no man's land between Lake Castaic and whatever is 20 miles to east.
Ojai.
Or west.
Yeah.
Ojai. And you get that. And it's just, and that is, so, and I love that there's a, the maintenance side of things. Because what would happen in that tank is slime and mold.
Sure.
Or not mold, that's but right. algae. And it would be slippery and brown and or whatever. But to put the brooms there, because it's just a known issue, but give a little scrub, you know, whoever stops by.
Yep.
And it's just like, you know, if you own a pool, you got to scrub the walls every once in a while.
Yeah.
This is a community pool and everybody's got to do a little scrub and it stays inviting for the next person. I think that's really cool.
Exactly.
That's a discovery. That's awesome.
You just need it hidden. Like there's no signs, right? It's just like, it's up there and you know about it from the maps. And, it's just, it was a really fun thing.
Well, the secret's out now.
Right. I'll see you there.
If you go, make sure you give it a scrub. Leave it better than you found it.
Absolutely. Leave it better than you found it. Love that. Well, good. Well, that sounds like another episode in the books. And well done. Great to hear.
Yeah. Good talking to you. And I look forward to next time.
One silver lining to the current times is the ability to attend great online events that would otherwise be missed because they're not in your local area. A great example is Send Cal Dreamin', coming up Tuesday, June 22nd and the 23rd from 9 to noon. It's not the full day, just the mornings on both days. Join me and other great speakers helping make the most of your Salesforce investment. It will cost only your valuable time and attention. More details at johnklein.com/CCD.